This conference will now be recorded.
Right, hello everybody, and welcome to today's Pepis's Inner Circle guest teleclass. And today I'm joined by a guest who I've interviewed before, and it was as I was just blowing smoke up his ass before we pressed record. it was actually a really popular guest teleclass with the team, and I think I've sort of figured out why just there now when I was talking to him. So, welcome back, Julian Northbrook.
Hello, or perhaps I should say long time no see.
It is, isn't it? Yeah. Well, last long time no here would be probably the last time we did the teleclass, which was sometime last year.
And have we spoken since then?
I think we've just exchanged messages, haven't we, probably?
But yeah, it's been a while for talking to your guys, but also talking to you as well. It's been too long, Dom.
No, it really has, yeah. It really has, because... And I'm looking forward to this. Like I just said before I press record, we haven't really had sometimes you have like a 10-15 minute catch up before or after the recording, but we haven't done that because I thought I would do it on air because I thought it would be interesting to for the guys to benefit from, you know, what's been going on in your world and stuff since we spoke to you last. So first of all, just introduce yourself, tell us a bit about what you do, and then we'll get into it.
Okay. Well, I'm Julian Northbrook. And just to give you the spiel that's probably the exact same spiel as I gave you last time, I'll be completely honest and say I don't actually remember. I am what you would consider a man of many hats in that I'm an entrepreneur. I run a business. I make money through coaching. English is the second language, and increasingly other language related bits and pieces, publishing books, YouTube, stuff like that. But I'm also an academic in that I'm quite heavily into the academic research side of things. Total side note, if I mentioned in the last teleclass that I was about to finish a PhD, that was a total lie because I ended up taking a break, and I am now actually about to finish it. I've literally got 10 days left to finish the writing and submit. So that's quite exciting in my life at the moment. Yes. I think that gives them all the info they need.
Definitely. Yeah. And I think we'll cover all of those things as we go. And like I said, I think one of the reasons why the telecast is so popular is because a lot of my guys are dog trainers. Probably about 40, maybe 50% of the people in the PBIC would be dog trainers. And even the people who aren't actually dog trainers, they probably have an interest in dogs and dog behavior and stuff. And I think the stuff that you talked about, you know, about learning, and we talk about benefits of learning a second language and just, you know, how the brain works and stuff like that. I think it's they took a lot of lessons away from that. And it's just interesting to hear things from a different perspective, isn't it? You know,
absolutely. And just to add something to that, I increasingly find that those different perspectives have so many crossovers, so much overlap, so many insights that lead into other things. I mean, just as an example, talking to you is a perfect example, but I was going to say Phil Agostino. He's been on my Extraordinary English Speakers program, talking about fitness and weight training and things like that. And like, when you think about it, like on a fundamental level, like learning a language and working out in the gym, they're actually basically the same thing. I mean, like we use slightly different terminology, but essentially, like the way it works and what's going on, ain't that much different.
No, indeed. No, yeah. Go on then. Amplify a bit more on that then.
I've opened up a can of worms now, haven't I? for example, with language learning, one of the things that we find, and one of the things that certainly the guys that I work with struggle with the most, is that as their level gets better, so does the difficulty to improve further. So when you're an absolute beginner in a language, just learning a few words, learning a few basic expressions, saying good morning, hello, could I have a beer, please? I mean, that's all pretty simple, pretty straightforward stuff. And then people see you and they see that you're obviously a beginner and they give you a lot of leeway. But then when you start to get better, like actually learning more becomes much, much harder because you've already got like this huge kind of mess of language that you've learned, and once you start to add to that, it's like diminishing gains. Not only that, but other people don't give you the kind of leeway as they used to, and it actually gets harder the better you get instead of easier. And I think that's quite similar to lifting weights in the gym. Like, you know, when you're like a skinny little bastard like me lifting fairly light weights, actually it does quite a lot to me. But the more you lift them, the more that you've got to lift to get the same kind of gain. So for Phil to get any kind of gains in his muscle compared to me is like, it's just like the difference is just enormous. I think Phil said it's called progressive overload in fitness, whereby you've got to progressively overload the muscles, i.e. keep on adding weight. Well, language is the same. And I guess in the same way, you can think of other things, marketing, for example, as also being quite similar. When you first start, it all seems quite simple. And then, you know, but then the more complex it becomes, the harder it becomes, I guess. Not something I'd ever actually thought about before I just said it, but I'm sure it's the same.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. Yeah, I think there are, I think the process has become sort of more complicated and multi-stepped, don't they? But they certainly that's I think so anyway. And you when you explain when I'm explaining, I've just did a teleclass about lead generation, and I was so pleased with it because I felt like it was the best. Even though I've explained lead generation like what feels like 40 or 50 times. it sometimes takes a long time to you forget how much learning you've done, don't you, and how much things you've done that have worked and haven't worked. And you know, when you're trying to explain it to someone who it's fairly new to, or you know, it's you really have to simply try and explain this complicated thing.
And it's hard, isn't it? And often we've got all this knowledge in our heads that we've never tried to explain to somebody, never tried to articulate before. I mean, just as an example, one of the things that I do with my coaching clients is getting them to almost to write their own brand story, like on a personal basis. So for example, I've got one lady I work with at the moment who's a secondary school English teacher. And one of the things that she needs to be able to do is kind of inspire her students and really to help them see that learning English as a second language is a good thing to do. Well, when we started to write her kind of origin story, how she became an English teacher, how she got into that sort of thing. I mean, obviously it's her life. So you could never say that, oh, she doesn't know anything about this because she's lived it for the last 20, however many years it is. But when it actually then comes to try and articulate that and explain it in a simple, concise, logical way, it's really, really hard to do. And I think it's the same. Like you said, you learn all this stuff about lead generation over years and years and years. And then like somebody says, okay, tell me the ABCs of lead generation. It's like, shit, where do I start? That tends to be my experience anyway.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And the challenge, like you said before, it's about motivating as well. You need to do it in a way that people they buy into it, they see the value in it, but they're not so overwhelmed by it that they think, fuck it, well, it's not worth the hassle, you know.
And that's the sweet spot, isn't it? I remember the first day my assistant Kim started, and I'm like, okay, right, I need to tell her everything that she needs to know. And I think about 2 hours later I'm still rambling on, and she's just looking at me like, oh my fucking god. this is crazy. It's just, oh, I just completely overwhelmed her with all this stuff, and then I had to stop and say, okay, let's just start at the beginning.
How did you go about that then? This is interesting for me from a personal point of view, because Beth's going to be leaving her job as teacher and joining the business later on in the year, and so she's going to be helping me with a lot of the stuff that I guess Kim's helping you with, and whoever else, you know. So how did you just literally have to go back and chunk it up and
how did I do it? Very, very badly is the honest answer. I think after basically dumping everything on her after a 2-hour meeting, realizing that she was just staring at me in total disbelief, having no idea anymore what I'm talking about, I think we literally went back to, okay, what are your working hours? When are you going to take your lunch break? Here are like the first things you need to do each day. I think we went right back to the beginning, and just kind of built it in over time from there, and it was fine and it worked out. But it's amazingly difficult to, excuse me, explain your entire day-to-day business process to somebody who has no idea what you actually do, aside from the fact that they've managed to get a job working for you. But there we go.
Well, stick with the business then. Let's start with the business. How has I'm trying to think now. I was going to try and find when it was that I actually spoke to you last. I'm guessing it was about a year ago. I'm guessing it was about a year. Yeah, let me see. Yeah, it was actually. It was the 8th of the 2nd, 2018. So crumbs were since our yearly anniversary almost, Julie.
Oh,
Brilliant. So,
gone.
what have been the changes in your business in the last year?
Oh God.
And you
and
can
this is
obviously
where
include
I'm.
in your life as well, I guess, because it's been quite.
Well, I mean, the two are synonymous, and I think that's a whole nother can of worms. I no longer see any distinction between my day-to-day life and my business because they are one in the same. And that's kind of part of the philosophy of marketing and branding that I've moved towards. But maybe we can talk about that later. The differences in my business, I mean, you wouldn't recognize my business anymore. I mean, some things
Wow.
are the same, of course. I mean, this might be interesting for your listeners, I hope.
Yeah, for sure. I think it will. If not, it'll be interesting for me, and that's all I'm interested in.
Well, I'm mostly interested in myself. So there we go.
At
So
least two of us will be happy.
this time next year, I just moved to Ireland from Japan. I mean, I lived there for 13 years in the end. Started my corporation in Japan in 2014 or 15, I can't remember which. And like, I love living in Tokyo, and it was an amazing place to live. But like the taxes and all of the stuff that corporations have to pay and do, and it was just drowning me, and I was having so many accounting problems. It was like my actual business itself was running smoothly, but then I was losing like the vast majority of all of what I made to the government, essentially. It's really not a very friendly place to start a business, or at least it wasn't a year ago, but I doubt anything's actually changed. Add to that the complexity of working with an accountant in a second language, which is what I was doing, who doesn't really understand what you do because it's so different to what anybody else is doing in Japan. I mean, like the whole concept of an online business is only recently becoming a thing in Japan. Like people think of it as being this really technologically advanced country, but actually, in terms of working processes, I mean, the fax is still the primary way that corporations communicate with each other.
Wow.
So,
Good news for Dan Kennedy.
and see that's when we were in Cleveland. I can't remember if you were there or not. And Dan Kennedy was talking about why he uses fax machines and things, fax to because it's positioning and it makes it hard to get hold of you and things. I'm just sitting there and thinking, like, in Japan, this is normal. I mean, everything you're saying is like normal. So, I mean, I was having loads of problems with the tax and the government and paying all the stuff that I had to do. On top of that, having to make money in British pounds, change it into yen, and then back to other currencies to pay for other things. And I was losing so much money to banks and things that I was just really quite struggling to keep the company running, even though everything should have been working really, really well. Well, moving to Ireland fixed all of that because I opened a new corporation here, and suddenly all of those like insane fees and things that I was paying just evaporated and disappeared. And it was like just overnight, my business became profitable and stable. And it's remained that way, which has been excellent to say the least. So if I sound more laid back this time compared to last time, I am, because I'm not having to count the pennies every 5 minutes anymore to make sure that I got enough money to pay the bloody government. But
Which is incredibly disheartening, isn't it? I guess, well, obviously it was for to be doing. I mean, business is always a bit of a struggle, isn't it? When you're trying to move on to the next stage or whatever. But you're a smart lad. You've got the right systems in place, and you're doing everything you need to do to grow it, and you're getting subscribers. You're selling things. But like you still, that must have been Well, it was, because I mean, I can remember, you know, I can remember speaking to you when you were incredibly pissed off as well, you know. So yeah, you good to hear you in a happy place, buddy.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And yeah, it's, I mean, it is disheartening and it's frustrating because it's exponential the amount that just gets sucked out of the business by various things. I think it's like the more money you make, the more people want to cut to that pie, as it were. And in an environment that's really just not set up or very friendly towards entrepreneurially minded people, it can make it very challenging, to say the least. Here in Ireland is completely the opposite because here they really encourage small businesses. And there's a lot like set up and in place to help people to do that sort of thing. So
Yeah.
it's a very different game living and working from here.
So without giving us numbers then, what kind of a difference did it make, sort of, you know, percentage wise, how much were you better off just by the move without
Well,
changing
okay.
anything else?
So it's kind of hard to give exact percentages because I mean it was like a thousand different things all combined, but I think every transaction around 55% of that was disappearing. So basically, if I made a sale, I needed to think, well, 45% of that sale is what's actually going to go into my bank account. So everything then had to be worked from there. Well, the tax here in Ireland is only like 12 or 13%. So it's like a huge difference. And you only pay on profit here, whereas in Japan you pay on revenue. So it's so that's and I hope I've got that right. So nobody quote me on that. I'm not an accountant, legal disclaimer. So but yeah, I mean it's so it's almost like 40 odd percent of every transaction has suddenly been freed up to put back into to marketing, into running the business, into doing various things. So that's been quite good. I've made other pretty big changes though.
Shoot.
I was really getting quite caught up with things like fancy video production, wanting to make lessons from my membership that were really, really well edited and beautifully filmed and just looked really, really nice. And what I realized is in order to do that, it was taking so much time and so much expense in terms of equipment, having to hire a video editor, which wasn't very going very smoothly, to be honest. He was a bit flaky, couldn't get himself into work on time every day, and that was also stress. So about 6 months ago, I made the decision to just go low tech. I announced it to my group and I just said, look, guys, you're not going to get these super polished, high audio quality, B-roll clips, all this great stuff, film like production added to everything. It's literally going to be me on my iPhone from now on. And I expected a load of people to get pissed off and quit because that wasn't the original deal. But you know how many people cared?
None.
None. Not a single person ever mentioned it. So that's made my life infinitely easier because what used to be like 2, 3 days to produce each lesson for my membership each week has now become it's now become 45 minutes, which has freed up loads of time. It's also freed up loads of expense because I no longer hire a video editor because I don't edit any videos. Instead, I'm now using that money to travel more. That's really one of the main things I'm now doing to market and promote my business, which is different to before, is actually traveling to different places, meeting people living in those places who are in my target audience, or running other English schools. Recently, I went to Taipei, spent a month there working with a language school in the city. We did a big event, got 80 people come along, made a ton of money from that, which was good. And also saw a whole different way of people living and doing things and language learning and different culture. So I'm going to repeat that process again in March when I'm going over to LA for a week and then New York for 2 weeks, just to do some videos and meet people.
Fabulous, fabulous, fabulous. Hey, that's brilliant. When did the penny drop, or when did the, what was the straw that brought the camels back, where you thought, fuck that for a game of soldiers, with regard to the video, snazzy video production?
Okay, so I'm wondering whether I should just be whether I should just tell exactly what happened here, because it's not sensitive information. It'd be quite embarrassing perhaps for the person. Yeah. Well, my ex video editor, but hey, fuck it. So basically what happened was he was being an absolute nightmare, and he was actually like he was hired to edit videos and do all this stuff. And it was supposed to free up loads of time, so I had more time to do marketing. But what was actually happening is he was being really flaky, couldn't get himself to work on time. I was constantly having to deal with his bullshit, and because he's like got a headache and I can't get in today, and he wasn't meeting deadlines. And then the office where he was working was getting really annoyed, and I kept having meetings with them. And I realized that actually he was using up more of my time than he was saving. Plus, I was paying for it. Plus, not only was I paying for him, and this kind of goes back to what I said before about, you know, the more complex things become, the more complex they become. In order to have a video editor, it meant I also had to have things like special Dropbox accounts in order to get files to him. I needed to pay licenses for this software, that software, and there was this service and that extra service, all basically so that he could actually do this work for me. And I calculated it all, and it was just like the amount of money that I was spending, basically to be stressed out with this guy who was messing me around. And then one day he said that he was he wasn't sure if he could do this anymore because he couldn't get up in the morning. And it was like something inside me just snapped, and I just said, "Fine, don't get up in the morning, don't come in again." And he was not as upset about it as he could have been. Basically, I just fired him. And then I realized what I'd done, and I was like, oh shit, just fired my video editor, but I'm really busy with other stuff. And now he's not coming back to the office. What am I going to do? I'm going to have to do all this editing myself. And that's when I just said, screw it, I'm just not going to do it anymore. So it was really more necessity than anything else, because I suddenly had this mountain of stuff that had to be done. And I didn't have the time to do it, and I was thinking, okay, I'm going to have to hire somebody else, and I just thought, no, fuck it, I'm just not going to do it. So I just didn't, and again, nobody has ever actually mentioned it.
Brilliant move, yeah, fantastic move.
Yeah, that was not as dramatic as I perhaps made it out to be from the beginning. Now I think about it, but yeah.
You didn't shoot anyone, that's a damn shame.
No, I think I made that out to be too dramatic, and then as I was telling the story, I thought, wait a minute, Andy, this isn't that interesting at all.
I need to spice it up a bit, yeah. A couple of big lessons for my guys really are here is... keeping things scratchy and keeping things lean and is desirable in my opinion. Now people think I would say that because I'm fairly slapdash as it goes. I am Mr. Done is better than perfect, and nothing I've ever done has been perfect. And this I've mentioned this many times to my guys. This whole inner circle was started with a landing page and an email series, and then I just communicated by email for the best part of about 8 months. And they just got links to, you know, I didn't have a website even. Do you know what I mean? There wasn't anywhere. They used to just get stuff. And don't get me wrong, for it's all fixed now, and now they've all got logins to Inner Circle areas with all the videos and everything. And everything gets uploaded and all like looks wonderful now. However, I didn't need that. I didn't need that at the start, you know. And you're far better off keeping things lean. And from I think I've heard this. You'll probably hear this as well, Julian, in the past. From a sort of often the case with adverts that you're doing, videos, or in just teaching and stuff like that. Scratchy is often better, isn't it? You know, keeping things scratchy, keeping it real. Sort of
I think so.
Yeah,
it's a I get, and it's part of it. I think is contrast, but with everybody else.
Exactly.
And I forget the. I could certainly dig it out if you wanted it. There's a video somewhere on YouTube that has analyzed basically the process. This guy analyzed the process that YouTubers go through when they create YouTube channels. Basically trying to stay on top of the algorithm to keep their videos like producing revenue via ads and things like that. And what he's basically talking about is like in the beginning, everybody starts with like their phone and then they get a little bit popular. But it's like, because they were new, that's why they got a little bit popular. Then as that then starts to slow down a bit, they panic and think, oh my God, I've got to keep this buzz going. They then look at other channels and they see that other people are using better cameras, so they invest in a better camera, which then needs more editing time, and but there's never any end to it. Like, they're constantly having to invest in more equipment, more stuff, more time in editing. Now suddenly, instead of just whacking a quick video up on YouTube, they are spending weeks planning it, weeks filming it, weeks editing it, and then they're making like 10 different variations of thumbnails to try and find the best one for the algorithm. And I think the point that this guy was trying to make in this video was that it there is literally no end to it, and it's like and that's why YouTubers and people who are doing this kind of business model become burned out so quickly, because they can't keep up with it, and then it all comes crashing down. And what I have found is, it's like, because that's what everybody else is doing, now I've started to post like the crappiest videos sometimes, just like filmed on my phone when I'm walking down. Like, almost all of my videos these days, I don't even do them inside because I can't be bothered to set up studio lights and it's dark in my office. So I just film them outside. I go out for a run and I'm just filming them down the cow shit splattered country lanes of West Cork. And it's literally me with my phone sweating because I've just been running. And then I do like a 3-4 minute video and people love them.
Yeah,
and they work so much better than my carefully planned videos ever did. So, goes to show.
No, it really does. Yeah, it really does. And I was going to say something else, but I can't remember what it was now. So are you still, is the content, obviously the content that you're putting out on YouTube, is that still the same quantity? And is it just the scratchy stuff as well now?
Yeah, in fact, I do more now because, like, it doesn't take me so long to make a video.
Of course,
I try to do a video every day. It doesn't always happen, to be perfectly honest. Content-wise, I mean, I'm doing the same thing. I'm basically just telling stories from my everyday life and then tying that into English learning. It's just that visually, you could say my branding, I guess, has changed an awful lot. Looks very different. Sounds very different. I think it's got more energy to it. Again, I think the important thing is the contrast between what I'm doing now and what other people are doing.
And that's always what you have to look for. I've just remembered what I was going to say before, actually. When we're talking about the videos, this is a prime example why we do plain, boring, ugly emails, isn't it? You know, we just text and story and personality, and that's it, you know. And you know, you shouldn't even, to me anyway, you shouldn't even have your logo or whatever on there, you know. Certainly, I tell my guys anyway, you know, just make it, you know, and then it's got, that makes it stand out, doesn't it, you know?
Absolutely. And on that note, about a month ago, one of my clients sent me an email. Actually, she's a user experience designer. And she said, I think your emails would do better if you put the call to action as like a button that visually stands out instead of just a plain text link. And I thought, okay, kind of not really what I'm doing, but I'll give it a go. I tested it. Instead of just like a plain, like the raw link just pasted into a plain text message, I put like a big green button there, and it's amazing how much it reduced the click-through rate, it visually obvious. And I think the reason why is because when it's visually obvious like that, although that is kind of the standard make the link stand out as much as possible and more people will click it kind of logic, I think actually what that meant is people weren't reading the email. Their eyes were skipping straight to the button and they were just thinking, well, I don't want to buy something, so I'm not going to click on that. And because they'd already got that far, they were just like, okay, well, what's next? Whereas when the link was just kind of a plain text link kind of hidden in the text, I think people were actually reading the email. And then by the time they got to the link, they were actually quite excited about what I was talking about and therefore clicking on it. I mean, the data that I collected from that, I mean, definitely isn't statistically significant. So shouldn't read too much into it. But certainly over three emails that I tested like that, the click-through rate was a lot lower, and I assume also than any people going through and becoming clients because of that HTML button. So I think the standard make things visually pretty, make them like HTML templates and things, big buttons instead of links. I think probably it actually isn't very good. And again, it's probably the contrast thing. Everybody else does the HTML templates. Therefore, yeah. The person who sends a shitty plain text email actually stands out. I can't remember where I heard this or who said it, but somewhere I read or heard the expression, in a world where everything is beautiful, ugly stands out. I think was the way it was phrased or something like that. I think there's a lot of wisdom in that.
I would agree. Yeah. I think just thinking about what you were talking about there with the, I think obviously the emails that we write are kind of a story which segues into a lesson, maybe which segues into a sale, and or might just segue straight from a story into a sale. But yeah, then you're right with the button. It's like your preconceived ideas are what I'm being sold to now, you know. Yeah. And in a way, the whole point of our emails are that we, you know, I mean, people don't get me wrong, people still get it, don't they? When they've been on the email list for a while, they get like, oh, okay, now he's they finished the story, but they're still reading them, you know. Whereas if they know that it's just going to be about the sale, then which goes to show, I guess, the lesson that there is, people, whoever that person was, Julian, most experts out there don't have a fucking clue what they're talking about, do they, when it comes to stuff, when it comes to marketing.
Absolutely. And it goes back to the whole idea of tactical thinking, doesn't it? Like the tactic, how can we make people click on the button? But you know, that's actually not what's important. What's important is the strategy, and the strategy for us is emotional engagement from people who are interested in our shit and at some point will be ready to buy. Perhaps not today, but that's okay. So we just you know, want to give them the opportunity to click on a link and buy something, but that's not necessarily the purpose of the email. The purpose of the email is to essentially get them sucked into my world and so caught up in what I'm doing and like loving everything that I've got to say that when they are eventually ready to buy, it's like it's a no-brainer. They're not gonna go to somebody else or shop around. It's just going, okay, now I've got to improve my English. Where's this Julian guy? And if I'm there in their inbox every single day, well, there he is.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, you are. So right, oh, excellent. Right, so big changes to the business just by moving country and scaling back. Well, say just by moving country. Obviously, it's quite a big step, isn't it?
Moving across the to the other side of the world. Yeah.
All you had to do was to move from Japan to Ireland. Oh dear! Reminds us of a Homer Simpson. I can't remember what it is now. I think it's when he's got a gay friend or something like that, and at the very end, Homer says something. The guy saves Homer's life, and Homer, you know, gives him a hug or something, and he says, "Homer, I finally won your respect, and all I had to do was save your life." Anyway, I'm going off on a one here. So what else has happened with the business then? What have you changed? Obviously, now it's enabled you to, like you said, travel more. Which enables you to. You're away more. You're able to produce better content for your guys. Even though it's scratchier, it's more kind of experience and immersive, I guess, isn't it, for them than you know, the bright shiny stuff that you were doing in your home studio before. What else has changed in the business? Are you offering anything else different? Are you what have your numbers been like, or have you not had to worry so much about you know, bringing more people in or whatever?
Well, I guess the numbers are really the same. Like my course has changed a little bit. I've increasingly found that, well, part of this is actually was with the move. Obviously Europe VAT is now a thing that I have to consider and deal with, whereas that was never the case when I was in Japan, because it was like, you know, digital product, not digital product. Like hands-on, hands-off, automated, not automated. I mean, it made no difference to me. Whereas here, like depending on like what I'm doing, you know, there's different VAT rates and this whole bloody, I can't remember what it's called, the digital VAT Nightmare. So really, just to avoid all of that, I've kind of changed a lot of, I started to change a lot of my stuff to coaching, group coaching. And actually found that although I resisted it because I thought, oh, I don't want to be doing group coaching calls and things and don't want to be using my time to do that, I actually found I really like it. And having more like actual time, I won't say one-on-one time because I don't really do one-on-one calls that often. It's all group coaching. But having that real time kind of Q&A kind of call with my clients is gave me loads of ideas for content and things that I never would have had before. And actually allowed me to see what they need and what they're doing and where they're struggling a lot better than in the past. So I've kind of done a rehaul of my courses and things based on that. Nothing major though. I mean, it's still really the same business. But the main difference for me now, I think, is again, like the front end stuff. I'm really just looking at spending a lot more time traveling. And actually doing things in person. And again, I think part of this is because it's something that I really want to do. I want to travel and I want to do more things. But part of it is again this contrast thing. In a world where suddenly everything is online, while offline stands out.
Absolutely.
It's just intrinsically more interesting. And I guess it's the same thing with say for example direct mail. In a world where everybody does email, sending something in the post has the kind of impact that it didn't say 20, 30 years ago when everything came in the post. So the main thing I'm now doing to promote my business front end and actually get people more interested is collaborative work with other English schools. Like I said before, I recently spent a month in Taiwan. We did a couple of events and things and some kind of stuff, parties and stuff, going out drinking with their clients. It really was as simple as that. Which was really, really good for both of us because me being there got them a lot of interest and a lot of people coming in because they wanted to see what I had to say and stuff. And it was great for me because a lot of their clients are kind of graduating from their courses, which only go up to the intermediate level anyway, and then wasn't too sure what to do after that. And they've now kind of moved over to my stuff, and it proved to be a very profitable venture for both of us. So what I'm now looking at is doing more of that. Like I said, I'm going to be in LA because I want to run the marathon. So I'm just kind of combining running with marketing. I ran the Taipei Marathon as well. Combining running with marketing, videos, content whilst I'm over there. It's more interesting stuff because it's different. It's not just me sitting in my home studio. Also, I'm talking to other English teachers, other people, meeting my own clients who live over the world. And it's hard to measure the results that are coming from it because it's not like, you know, like a Facebook ad or something where you can see how many people click and how many people buy, but it's having a big impact on my business and what I'm doing. So it's very exciting, I think, for me at the moment.
For sure. No, it sounds it, buddy. And where did so what you've said, correct me if I'm wrong here, but just to put it in perspective for my guys, before you were, it was kind, you were kind of isolated, weren't you, I guess, as a,
Oh, yes.
you know, position. I mean, not just geographically isolated, but you're isolated as a, you know, I'm Julian, the language teacher guy, whatever. And whereas now you're kind of, you're putting, you're going where the fishes are, aren't you, type of thing, and you're finding ways to, well, you're
To actually get
finding
out
ways
there.
to, you're getting out there, and you're putting yourself amongst people, other people in your, not in your industry, because they don't do exactly what you do, but you, which is like you say, it opens doors, doesn't it, when you do that?
Yeah, absolutely. Just really just looking for crossovers and just ways that I can just get involved in other people's projects and involve them in mine. And yeah, I was very isolated in the way that I was doing things because I always had this the I guess the internet business dream where I'd have I think I was I think the main thing before is I was constantly chasing this concept of passive income whereby I was going to set everything up and then once it was set up I was just going to be able to leave it and I was going to be able to go off and you know sit in the park reading my book all day or something like that. But it was like I was constantly chasing that, I think, and it never seemed to come. It was like always there was always something else that needed to be done, needed to be created, needed to be set up. And it was like that income was always kind of a step or two ahead of me. And I sort of stopped doing that now. And I've now just really looked for ways that I can actually be more hands-on in the business. So instead of making it more passive, I've kind of gone the other way.
And just the passive thing's interesting because a lot of my guys are just with the trainers and stuff will be saying, well, I want to put my training online and that, and they think it's just a matter of, you know, putting the lessons online and then people are just going to like flock through the door, and that totally is not how it works at all. And I think it's a myth, isn't it, really? I mean, Christ, we've been doing this a long time now, haven't we? And that I don't know anybody really who is sitting, you know, with I mean, there are elements of my business that are passive now, but I've still had to do a lot of work to get them where they are. As you have as well. And I think the trick is to build a business around the kind of life that you want to have, and
absolutely,
and understand that you're gonna have to do certain things, and yet you might even enjoy those things, you know, like you're enjoying going out, you know. And do you think, just to skip ahead a bit, do you think this was, Julian, think you maybe you just because of the situation you were in before, and the financial pressures that you were under before that, do you think maybe you were just chasing your tail too much and that you couldn't see any of these opportunities at the time or what?
Absolutely. Because there's like the ridiculous fees and all the kind of hidden costs that I had in Japan, I think income never seemed to stretch far enough. Once you've got the surplus cash and surplus time, and like, once I cut down on the amount of editing and all of this kind of, in terms of, I know, 80-20 terms, the 20% stuff that takes 80% of the effort and brings very little results. Once I just stopped doing all of that, suddenly I just had extra time, and I was like, okay, well, how am I going to fill this time? Well, let's fill it with something useful rather than just filling it with more stuff that I think is useful, or just more busy work, I guess. So yeah, no, you're absolutely right.
Cool. So what any other changes you can think of that have happened? Are you still publishing? Are you, have you added anything else into the mix, or got rid of anything else?
Yes and no. Did I talk about the Kindle stuff last time?
Yeah, I believe so. We didn't go into great deal about it, but yeah, it was, I think you had, you know, I think you've been doing it a few months then, haven't you, probably?
Yeah, and that was amazing. And that was actually the only bad thing about moving over here. And if there ever was a route to passive income, I would say it's probably Kindle. It would probably just take years and years and years to actually get the ball rolling. But once it is rolling, it works quite nicely. Before I moved over here, I was making on average about 900 to 1,000 in Kindle revenue each month. When I moved over here, because the KDP Japan and KDP in the rest of the world is actually a totally separate entity because of the laws over there. The only way to keep that running was to transfer everything over to the other KDP. I lost all my rankings in Amazon. I think in one month, I went from £1,000 a month to about 50, I think. I just died, Christ, overnight. And I never managed to get that working again. So I've pretty much stopped that now.
Right. Interesting. Interesting. Okay.
It's something to go back to in the future, I think. It was just so much work to get it running in the first place. Just the idea of now going back to square one with all of that, which is easier said than done, because once the books are published, I think Kindle has a period of about a month whereby if your book is popular in that first month and people are buying it and people are engaging with it, reviewing it, I don't know this to be true, but I think this is the case. That will then kind of dictate where it sits in the rankings long term. But because I transferred stuff over, obviously I didn't have that initial rush of excitement, new book, or my audience buying it because they'd already bought it. It then kind of just appeared to be an unpopular book that nobody wanted, and just kind of disappeared into the ether that is Amazon's website. So in order to get that up and running again, I really need to be writing new books and getting people to rebuy those and to be doing that. That's just easier said than done. Not impossible. Just a shitload of work.
Other fish to fry now, but yeah, better opportunities. Things change, don't they, all the time? Brilliant. So, tell us about your PhD then.
Oh, it's almost finished, and right now that's all I care about. I can't remember what I said last time, so hopefully I'm not contradicting anything, but I don't think I am. I started my PhD back in the day when I still thought I was going to be an academic and I was going to work in a university. Then I, very quickly, about a year after I started the PhD, just realized, like, oh my God, the bullshit in the politics that goes on in those places. Like, I just, the more I got to know people in the world of academia, like, the less I wanted to do with it. So that's part of where my business came from in the first place, because it was like, well, what everybody does is they want to do research. Basically, that's what most academics are really into, is the research side of it. But, you know, the way that they fund that and pay for it is by working in a university, teaching, lecturing, doing all that extra stuff in Japan, admin as well, because it's like, basically, academic staff in Japan get treated like shit. They're everything from admin staff to salespeople to teachers, and it's a nightmare. So I just wanted nothing to do with that. And that's kind of how I ended up starting my business. So I started really my business in earnest about a year or two after I started my PhD. Then, of course, the more excited I got about that, the less I could be bothered with the PhD, but I just never kind of quit it. I kind of just kept on doing the bare minimum. And then at some point I took a really long break. So I'm now going back to research that I did 6 years ago. No, more. 2013 was my main research project. So about 7 years ago, and I'm finally actually writing that up into a thesis.
Right. Wow. And wow. On what?
What? Sorry.
On what?
So the title. Let me tell you what the title is. I actually can't remember exactly what the title was. It's a bit of a weird title, but I can tell you what it is. The title is, How Many CDs Do You Have? The Impact of Teaching Materials on Formulaic Language Processing in Japanese Learners of English. Which probably tells you absolutely nothing about what it's about. excuse me, spluttering and coughing, by the way. We're all over colds recently here, so it's mostly gone, but it's still there a little bit. Basically, what my research was about is I was interested in the impact of the teaching materials that we give students. So the traditional way of teaching a language is really to consider language as a set of grammar rules to study, and then kind of almost as an afterthought vocabulary to learn. And the idea is that you're going to learn these grammar rules, and then you're going to be able to slot the words that you've memorized into those, and then you're going to be able to speak. But like anybody who's tried to learn a language or even just remembers school French just knows that it just doesn't work like that. It just, like, you just don't go from memorizing all of those boring grammar rules to suddenly be able to speak the language in a fluent, natural sounding kind of way. But that's still how teaching materials are made. Like the quality of the materials, especially in secondary schools, tends to be very, very low, because basically the way that textbook writers make them is they start with the grammar rule first, and then they just make up examples. But the trouble is our intuition about what constitutes good, high-frequency, natural-sounding language is actually quite shit. So when you look at these textbooks and you actually compare them to real language, they're totally different. Like the phrases and expressions used in them, and the combinations of words don't match like real, like, conversational English that comes out of a native speaker's mouth at all. So what I wanted to know is to what extent does that actually impact long-term performance of students if they've studied and learned from those materials does that then influence the language that they will produce later on? And the conclusion that I came to was yes. So in Japan in particular, like, there's a lot of criticism about the school system saying, you know, students study for 10 years and but they're not able to speak the language at all. What my research kind of showed is actually that's bullshit. They actually speak really, really well. But the things that they say and the things that they're able to say are totally different to what a native speaker will ask them, because they've studied things like, how many CDs do you have? I have 10 CDs. How many CDs do you have? Which, you know, is not a conversation that comes up in day-to-day life. Yet in those conversations, they are highly fluent. Just they're kind of fluent in this, in almost fluent, like a different
completely
thing.
Irrelevant.
Yeah. And so that's what my research was all about. And then towards the end, it was more about actually creating and optimizing language learning materials that can teach the language efficiently whilst also delivering well distributed language. And what I mean by that is kind of natural samples of language which actually match what a native speaker does without totally overwhelming the learner. And obviously, obvious to me, but I guess that depends on whether people know what I do or not. My Extraordinary English Speakers membership program, which is my weekly lesson program, of course, those lessons are essentially what I did in the end as the bulk of the research towards the end of the project. Basically, I used my PhD as a way to develop my lessons and in turn my business in the end. And now I'm just writing that up into a thesis that can be presented as a piece of research. And then I will be a doctor, which is totally pointless for me at this point in my life. But it'll be fun when I have to book restaurants and things like that.
Yeah, pretty cool. Pretty cool, my friend. Yeah, I like it. I like it a lot. Excellent, excellent. So, right, well, we're rapidly approaching the end of the call now. So what? Tell me what the plans are for the future, for the rest of the year, et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, my God. Plans so far. March, I'm in the US. Can't wait for that. Really looking forward to it. April, May, at some point, I will have my PhD examination and I will become the doctor. the doctor. Total digression, but I'm just looking forward to the day when you see it on TV all the time. You're on a plane, you're in a restaurant, and somebody has a heart attack, and they call out, "Is there a doctor here?" You sound like, "Yes, I'm a doctor. Doctor of linguistics." So that's got to be done in the next 3 months, because as soon as I submit the thesis, that's looming. So I can't really plan anything at the moment beyond that. June, I have an event in London planned. Didn't start selling that yet, but I've got an event in London planned. From there, August, I think I'm actually back in Taipei to do another event there with my contacts over there. I've got no idea. I don't plan that far ahead, Dom.
That's good enough. That's good enough. Yeah, excellent. No, good stuff. Busy. We're nice and busy anyways. Good to hear.
Busy, but in a good way. It doesn't feel like work, I think, is the key.
Beats working for a living. Like it. No, brilliant. Well, on that note then, we'll wrap it up. So where can people go to find out more about you and what you do and check out some of your now scratchy content?
Okay. So my website is doingenglish.com, which is probably what I said last time too. Failing that, people can find me on LinkedIn, which I use periodically, not as much as I should, but increasingly I'm using more. And my YouTube channel is also Julian Northbrook. Basically, if you type Julian Northbrook into anything, it's going to be me, because I don't think, as far as I know, there is not another Julian Northbrook in the world, or at least certainly one who uses the internet. So you can basically just type Julian Northbrook wherever you like and you'll find me.
Tinder.
I thought it was called Grindr.
I was being polite.
I'm neither on Tinder nor Grindr.
Brilliant, brilliant. Well, I had a couple of languagey things written down, but I'll think we'll probably do another one of these. We won't leave it a year though. Maybe we'll leave it 6 months or so till you've had your next bout of travels. God, I think I've caught your cold. And then because I know my guys, I'll get some questions for them as well, and we'll do a bit more of a languagey teleclass next time. How does that sound?
Absolutely. Anytime. I am always up to talk to you, to your guys. My pleasure.
Thanks so much, buddy. Yeah, well, in that case, then, I'm going to wrap this up. So thank you once again, Julian Northbrook. Thank you.
Thanks, Dom, and thanks to all your people.